Hey, good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending upon where in the world you are. I am Eric Rubenstein. I am the Advice Health Director of Litigation, Fraud, Waste, and Abuse. Welcome to another episode of the OIG Roundtable. I am joined, as always, with my fellow retired OIG folks. I never say former, because that implies something nefarious occurred with us. And as far as I know, you may have been charged but not convicted, so you're still good. But with that being said, I've got my fellow compadres from the OIG from the roundtable, Wade McFall, who is a retired assistant special agent in charge from the Los Angeles field office. I'm also joined by Jason Eisengrein, retired special agent in charge from HHS OIG and the retired UPIC West director. And retired also from a lot of other places. Social Security, I think, is where he actually started. And then I'm also joined, of course, by Matt Kachansky, retired senior executive with HHS OIG, and then went on to be the Northeast UPIC director, also recently retired, coming over to advise. So we're here to talk to you for the next 30 minutes or so about the constant iteration of things that are going on in the fraud, waste, and abuse world. Today, we want to talk about statistically valid random sampling, probe sampling, rat stats, and the like. For those of you that are joining us on this podcast today and you have seen or heard or thought about rat stats, here it is in all of its glory. For those of you that have turned your head away from it because it really does hurt your eyes when you look at it, I can absolutely understand that. RatStats is a software program that came to fruition in something like the late 70s. It has gone through a few lipstick on a pig is probably the best way to describe iterations, where it's been changed from a visual perspective that it hasn't really been changed under the hood ostensibly since its inception. It is the OIG's gold standard platform for statistical sampling. It is used by CMS. It is used by the MACs. It is used by the UPICs. It is used by the Office of Inspector General, where we came from. It is used by commercial payers and Medicaid alike. Whether you like it, you don't like it, that's not really the purpose of our conversation today. There are probably a million other platforms that are out there that are used by other organizations, statisticians, and biostatisticians, but it is what is used. We're not going to really be spending a lot of time talking about RatStats as an entity or as a tool, but I do think it's important to understand that RatStats is used kind of across the board in the fraud, waste, and abuse world. One of the things that's interesting about RatStats is that the typical sample size that you'll see in a lot of the guidance that's out there, both in things like the self-disclosure protocol and other regulatory guidance, is this premise that the minimum sample size should be 100. And I think that generally speaking, anybody who is a qualified statistician, including advises a doctoral level statistician, will argue that a sample size needs to be commensurate with what the universe is. And so we're not really here to have a discussion. None of us are statisticians. We're not really here to have a discussion about whether or not a sample size of 100 is appropriate or not. But we want to talk a little bit about how statistical sampling is used from an investigative perspective, from the UPICs, from the MACs, and the like. So I'm going to start with Matt, because, you know, on a couple of conversations that we've had, there's always been this discussion that comes up about sampling and probe samples versus statistical samples. And Matt, I'm going to turn it over to you to start so you can give our viewers, listeners, and people that are subscribing to our podcast, what is the main difference between a probe sample and a statistical sample?
The bottom line is, in a probe sample, you are choosing specific claims that you want to look at based on the facts of the case that are in front of you. And the results of those reviews are then only applied to those specific claims. So there's no extrapolation of the overpayment. It's, you looked at 50 claims, denied 40 of them, an overpayment amount would be just applied to those 40 claims. With a statistical sample, you are looking for a universe of which you then use a methodology, maybe RatStats, maybe something else, to select a statistically valid sample of that universe. You do your medical review of that sample, and then the results of that sample can then be extrapolated over the entire universe of those claims. So in the first example, you may look at 40 claims, the universe may be 1,000, so the overpayment can then be extrapolated to the 1,000 claims based on the results of that sample review.
Now, the interesting part about that is when we're talking about a probe sample, any overpayment that's identified in a probe sample is what would colloquially be termed as an actual overpayment, right? Because you've looked at a specific set of claims, you've identified whether or not that claim should be paid, it should be denied, or it should be changed to something else, and you get an actual number. Whereas in a statistical sample, the purpose of the extrapolation, which is the fancy term for going across the universe, is to identify what that overpayment is sort of in the aggregate, right?
Correct. Yes.
Right. So
it's just, you know, if you're using a correct methodology, it is an actual overpayment. It's just statistically accurate and statistically actual, not specific to the actual claims that you've physically reviewed.
Sure. And so, Jason, now I want to turn over to you because you've spent in a lot of the time over in the Western UPIC, you know, and we've talked a lot about this, that whatever the number of hospices are around the country, the estimate is that something like half of them are in California. And the Western UPIC was your jurisdiction. I think you had something like 11 or 14 states that you oversaw fraud, waste, and abuse for. And so there's some nuances, right, on things like hospice and home health and the like. And so my question to you is, you know, talk to our viewers about how is sampling, where some of those nuances may be across some of the specialties that might exist when doing either a probe or statistical sample.
Sure. So the first question that one wants to ask is, what is the outcome that you're looking for? Are you looking to recover money or are you looking for information? Probe samples are great for establishing a business case for, you know, doing additional work in a particular service area, no matter what it is. But it also is one thing to consider is that when you go down the road of a probe sample with the idea that, well, maybe it'll lead to additional work, once you gear up for that probe sample and then you use that to decide whether you want to go forward or not, sometimes you're back to square one, where if you just got into it in the beginning and you already put your resources in place to do the medical review, the investigative work, or whatever else that goes into the outcome, you would have been better off just starting off with that. But the other good things you can determine as you go down in a probe sample is deciding, well, what kind of confidence level do you need to have from that sample? Because that can be ratcheted up or down depending on the need. Back to your specific question about the service area. So statistically valid random samples are especially important in the high volume claims areas. So evaluation and management codes and those types of things that have large claim volumes, it's very difficult to get a return on investment from program integrity effort in those areas without a statistically valid random sample. In areas of service like hospice that you brought up, there are generally fewer claims in a hospice. So is the statistically valid random sample really necessary if you have like five patients that you're dealing with? So it probably doesn't pay. Plus, there are complexities of the actual effort that goes into the investigative or audit work relative to that. So, you know, maybe it's an issue of curative versus palliative care or any other, you know, nuances to hospice. So, you know, you should use it probably sparingly, in my opinion anyway, in terms of hospice. But in some other areas, and you mentioned the Western jurisdiction, home health is a significant concern. And SVRS would be a very good tool to use in that service area.
So there's a lot to unpack there, and I want to go to Wade for a minute. And so, you know, as an agent and as a supervisor, you know, you and I as an agent, we would get these referrals from the UPICs, and they would have information in there relative to either a probe sample or a statistically valid random sample. Now, I won't give you my opinion because I want to hear yours, but you know, we would get a referral, and sometimes a referral would have a probe sample annotated with an overpayment. And then sometimes there would be a statistical sample, which would have an overpayment. When you would get those cases as a supervisor or as an agent, did you put any credence or credibility to one versus another?
Well, we would typically look at a probe as more of like one of those tools in your tool belt. It's going to kind of give you the really broad overview of what you can expect for the case. And it's obviously not for the purpose of extrapolation, but that was definitely like, you know, page one or two of the referral. It's like, this is just to give us an idea of what the overpayment is going to be expected to be using a probe as opposed to a statistically valid random sample.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when I would get a referral and I would see a probe sample, to me, that was intelligence. You know, I can tell you that on the provider side of the advice house that I do most of my work on, when I'm doing compliance related work and my provider community asks me, you know, what should we do for an audit? I said, well, you can do a statistically valid random sample, but it's costly to do it. And, you know, there may be some broader implications for that. But if you're just looking for internal intelligence gathering, you know, do you have opportunities? And, you know, we talked a little bit before we did start the recording where I talked about revenue preservation and revenue generation, that doing a review on the provider side proactively to help meet the OIG's compliance guidance. There's 7 points to OIG's model compliance guidance. One of those is self-audit. And by self-audit, we mean the fox shouldn't watch the hen house, right? So the billing manager shouldn't be doing an audit of the billing clerk. And because I can guarantee you that if you have a 100% accuracy rate, there's probably something wrong there. But, you know, there's an important piece of that, which is that you get this information and it's supposed to give you a little bit of, for lack of a better term, tactile feedback, right? What is the problem? Is there smoke where that fire is? And so, Matt, I want to go back to you because I talk about revenue preservation, revenue generation, right? If you're a provider and you do this work to try to be compliant and you find opportunities, well, heck, this needs to be fixed. This is revenue preservation. I need to make sure that my billing and coding is commensurate with my documentation. It's a 360-degree view, right? The UPICs are looking at 360 degrees, meaning they're looking at whatever documents are given. If a CPT code is under audit or review, investigative review, but a provider submits a document with 3 CPT codes, those 3 CPT codes are being looked at. It's not just kind of this myopic view. And so it's because it's investigative, it's not audit. And so there's these revenue preservation issues that I say, but I also talk about revenue generation, meaning did a provider miss an opportunity to bill for a code that they could have legitimately billed for pursuant to NCDs, LCDs, LCAs? Pursuant to plan policy or something? Are there opportunities that were missed? Did a provider undercode something like an E&M that they could have or whatever? And the thing that I always found interesting when I was an agent, to the chagrin of many, was, okay, we've got this overpayment and that overpayment is X number of dollars, but is that overpayment extrapolation or actual? Is it also including underpayments or opportunities that were missed? Because you can't just punish someone for doing something. You should reward them for the things that they may have done right or what have you. And so I want to go back to you, Matt, because you and I started to talk about this as it's a real thing.
It absolutely is. And under the mission of the UPICs, you know, we were there to identify, you know, potential fraud, waste, and abuse, and overpayments. We were specifically mandated not to look for the underpayments. So if there was an undercoding of an E&M, you know, we wouldn't mark that. We wouldn't say, oh, this has to be taken away from the overpayment. It was ignored or just simply marked as, you know, accurate claim. So, you know, that was something that, you know, we that was standard operating procedure.
So that kind of gets to the next piece. And Jason, I want to go to you, and then I'm going to go back to Matt, which is that, do you take the position, or does the fact that there is an instance where that exists, does that call into question the legitimacy of statistically valid random sampling if you're not doing both a credit and a debit in the same sampling? Meaning, well, if we found an error rate of 35%, or make up a number, that error rate is based upon an overpayment, isn't it possible then that the error rate could actually be higher but be in favor of a provider?
In the world of the science of it, I'm sure that is an accurate statement. I'll say that it's all about setting the expectations up front. So, for instance, if it's Medicaid related, the state may have specific requirements. For instance, maybe there is a requirement that repricing is needed as part of this effort, audit, investigation, whatever it is. So, for instance, if it's an E&M code, then there truly was a visit. It just wasn't a 45-minute, extended visit. Well, there's still a payment due. So, is repricing necessary? Back to the confidence level. What is the confidence level that is expected as a result of the process? So, yes, is the answer to your question in short that sure, if a payment, was due, there should be credit in a credit debit situation for that. But I think it's really part of developing a good audit plan or investigative plan, and keeping the people that are entitled to know about the process informed of what those expectations can be.
So I think that's actually a really important point, is that, so first of all, I think everybody has the level set, is that the OIG's mission is to ferret out fraud, waste, and abuse within the program. And the UPIC's mission is collaterally similar, right? It's investigating and ferreting out fraud, waste, and abuse with the programs. It's not identifying instances where the provider had a boo-boo and undercoded or missed an opportunity. So while we can all agree that this is kind of, it's a two-sided coin, we always have to understand that from the payer's perspective, and, I always describe the UPICs as the special investigations units of Medicare. It's just the easiest way to put it. But, the purpose of an SIU or the purpose of a fraud or benefit integrity group is not to identify areas where the provider, failed to do something that could have benefited them, right? That's the purpose of them having compliance. It's the job of the UPIC and the SIUs to identify fraud, waste, and abuse in kind of that order. But Matt, I want to go back to you for a minute, because, we've talked about the process, prepay, postpay, and in our other podcasts, we've talked about the initial denial that comes in on a claim. We've talked about reconsiderations, redeterminations. I always get them mixed up, which is the vernacular, but the process being UPIC level, MAC level, quality improvement contractor, or the QIC level, and then the ALJ level. And there was something that you said at one point, which has resonated for weeks with me, which is that most of the appeals that you saw go up to the ALJ in the Northeast UPIC were appeals based upon the statistical sampling and a challenge or an attack on that sampling. So let's talk a little bit about that. What are some of the things that were like those attacks? So no one is arguing about whether the documentation was there or not there. The argument is on the sampling, which then leads to the extrapolation. So a provider may say, well, you got me, but it's not $1 million, it's $30,000.
Right. Yeah, the attacks would be against the definition of the universe, that it was skewed, as you brought up in an earlier example, or that the methodology used for stratification, or depending on the complexity of the SVRS, the things that were used to determine the extrapolated amount were not based on the universe correctly. And you know, so our statisticians spent a lot of time going to these ALJ hearings defending their methodology. The very complex part of that is sometimes it wasn't their work that they were defending, because these ALJ hearings may take place 5 years, 7 years, 10 years, 12 years after the claim was submitted or that the review was done. So the statistician could be defending the work of another statistician, even of another contractor. And that gets very, very difficult to do. And it's very time consuming for the statisticians to do that.
Yeah. So Wade, let's go. I want to turn it over to you for a minute, because I know we've talked previously about, you know, as a supervisor, as an agent, you know, we're not actively involved in this, right? Because this isn't getting to us. But I know in some of the conversations that we've had, you were finding or hearing along the way that in LA, there were a lot of these cases that were going to the ALJ level, and you were going and kind of just sitting in or talking to people about like what was going on. What did you kind of overall get as your, what was your takeaway from that? What did you learn?
Well, we met with the ALJ in that covers LA, which is in Irvine, and with their staff. And it was surprising to me to find that, you know, the case, when it goes before an ALJ, the case has to stand on itself, the case file itself. There's no agent that goes along to provide any backup or explanation. It's like, here's the case file, that's it. And the provider, on the other hand, can be present and can challenge things and answer questions, ask questions. But the government's case, it's just strictly the case file. It's going, it's a paper file. And that was a little bit surprising to me, because we were finding that a lot of our cases that were going to ALJs were being overturned or being decided with the provider. And when we would review it afterwards, it was, in our opinion, it was being decided on either inaccurate information or false information. We didn't have the ability to say that's not exactly true, and here's a document to refute it. It was just the case file, and then the providers, you know, were making arguments that we couldn't back up. It's like not being able to be cross-examined, basically.
Right. I mean, obviously, one of the challenges for the government on these matters is that when it goes to each subsequent level, the provider gets to give more information, new information, different, however you want to characterize it. It could be information that the provider obtained an hour before they submitted it that didn't exist a year ago, right? And the government's case is static, right? It's a static set of documents, and the provider's documents are dynamic. They can continue to kind of bring this through. But so Jason, I want to close out with you on something. So statistical sampling is a staple of fraud, waste, and abuse related investigations, regardless of who it is. And CMS has spent a substantial amount of time in explaining it and discussing it. What do you see as being some of the areas where if Jason Eisengrein was asked his opinion about statistical sampling and updating the what's known as the PIM, the Program Integrity Manual, which for those that don't know it, there's two sets of manuals. There's the Claims Processing Manual and there's the Program Integrity Manual. The Claims Processing Manual is basically the document that's out there that tells providers how to bill things and how to document things to properly bill and get claims out. It's essentially like your in-network provider agreement if you are in the commercial space, for lack of a better term. And then the Program Integrity Manual is kind of the how is fraud, waste, and abuse investigated and how are things dealt with. If Jason Eisengrein was given a red pen, because red is the color of hope, according to Jason, and you had the ability to make changes to the Program Integrity Manual, what sort of things would you think you would want to see to strengthen the ability of the government to have more defensible statistical sampling methodologies?
Well, first and foremost, it would be about consistency. And so in the consistency aspect, I would say it's more relevant or more applicable, or I guess more in need in the Medicaid arena. So since Medicaid is a state administered program, and the states have a wide variety of sampling methodologies. Some are silent on it, which makes it even more difficult. Having a consistent SVRS policy, so whether you're a fan of rat stats or not a fan of rat stats, that is the best part about rat stats, is that it's highly consistent. It's right there on the OIG website. Everyone can see it and either love it or hate it as they choose to do. So similarly for Medicaid, it would be about the consistency. I would also say that there can be high level discussions about communication of the expectations of it. So, you know, if in an investigation, it's one thing, because it might be more consistent with something that law enforcement will end up having in its inventory. But in some instances where it's an audit and you take the principles of the generally accepted government auditing standards or other like documents, I would just say that the communication with the provider, so that the provider knows what to expect, and to have those discussions before it gets to the long line of appeals. Because I know on several of these podcasts, we've talked about, well, why does it take so long? And Matt mentioned about, you know, 12 years later, potentially arguing a matter. Well, you know, I would just suggest that knowing those parameters more upfront might help limit some of those more protracted hearings and appeals processes.
Yeah, so Matt, I'm gonna we're gonna wrap up, but I want to close out when Jason talked about consistency, and you shook your head. So we already know that there is issues with consistency in the Medicaid side, and that's just due to each state's program being state administered and its unique sovereignty, right? And each state having either great some or none when it comes to program integrity, and we know that Medicaid has been a bane of existence for a lot of people in the fraud space who, you know, love to write on LinkedIn and the blogs about how poorly managed fraud, waste, abuses on the Medicaid side. But do you see a consistency issue within the government space as it relates to statistical sampling, meaning are the UPICs being fairly consistent?
I believe the UPICs are being fairly consistent. The statisticians for all the UPICs meet and go over methodologies and come to an agreement. But if you take the UPICs and then you throw in the MACs and the RACs, you know, we'll be, you know, there was a point in time where the UPICs would do an extrapolated overpayment and the MACs wouldn't accept it because they were in disagreement with the methodology that the UPICs were using. And so there was this, you know, a lot of contention between those two sets of contractors, to the point where CMS had to get involved, hire a third contractor to come in to try to resolve the differences and come up with a more universally acceptable methodology. And I had left at the time that they were still trying to do that.
You know, it's interesting, and I'll close out with this, is that, you know, when I first got hired as an agent, a very wise guy that mentored me once told me that the biggest arguments and fights that I will ever have as an agent, it will never be with the defense, it'll never be with U.S. Attorney's Office, it'll never be with lawyers. He went through a litany of people and things. His argument, to his point to me, was your biggest arguments and fights will always be with CMS. They want to give away the money, we want to keep the money. And I think that when you look at that UPIC versus the MAC, that's a little bit of the same thing, right? The UPIC's focus is controlling fraud, waste, and abuse from a benefit integrity perspective. And the MAC's job is to pay out the claims. And so that what you just said didn't surprise me. 26 now years or so later, almost 30 years in this space, for me, it continues to resonate. And I use a lot of the Eisengrinisms in my day-to-day. That's one I use pretty frequently because there is a lot of truth to that there are these conflicting and competing sort of interests in how this is done. But, you know, none of this should be a surprise to anybody who's listening to these podcasts. You know, when we work and live in a pay and chase environment, we have to deal with what the hands that we're dealt. And so, you know, we're obviously trying to make the best of it. I think from the provider side, statistical sampling and probe sampling has an absolute definitive place in proactive compliance. And I would even say that if we look at the 7 points of the OIG's model compliance, I have a good friend that does compliance work, and he always says there's really an eighth point or a 7A, and that's mitigation, meaning what are the things that you're going to do to mitigate your risk? You know, we see this all the time. People have risk mitigation strategies in a lot of aspects of business, and they don't necessarily do it with their billing and coding compliance. So this just kind of, you know, it adds to it. So, you know, it is what it is. But thanks again, as always. You know, I love these conversations. I always learn something when I talk to all of you. We all have these really different perspectives. We all cut from the same cloth because we all had the same job, but we all have just a little bit of a nuance or a spin. So it's been great. For those of you that continue to subscribe to our podcast, either catching it on our newsletter, getting it off of our website, subscribing to our YouTube channel, you can always get our newsletter, send an email to us at hello@advise, A-D-V-I-Z-E, health.com. We'll get you signed up for that newsletter. We really appreciate all the support you've got. We look forward to our next OIG roundtable and, of course, our collateral podcast that we do, which is the OIG Files. Those come out as well. We look forward to continuing. Hope everybody has a good Thanksgiving holiday, and we'll see you on our next podcast. Thanks very much.
Thank you all.
Thanks.